Just a word about armored regiments. At the time, in the 50s and 60s, they were fully armored regiments. We had tanks and all the kit and people that go with that. The tanks, as mentioned before, were Centurion Mark V's. And in the 70s, late 60s, things changed. Our role in Europe changed. We left the north end of Germany, where we had been with the British Army on the Rhine. Half of our troops were brought home. The other half went to where our air bases were in southern Germany, almost as south as far south as you can get, up the Rhine River, at Lahr and Baden. And the other half that had gone home, they were on notice to go back to Europe should a situation arise requiring mobilization of that sort. And those were the years, we call them the Trudeau years, starting in 1968 and onward, and roles changed. We also picked up, I didn't have anything to do with it, participate in it, but we also agreed to send an air transportable brigade to Norway should they run into trouble with the Russians. And that was, we were geared in that one for winter warfare, war on skis. Everything was painted white for that occasion. So it's not like the ball was dropped or anything like that. Things changed, and Canada could only afford so much at the time anyway. So the armored regiments changed as well. Only the armored regiment in Germany had tanks. The Lord Strathcona and the Fort Garry Horse back in Canada had much lighter armament from that time on. In 1970, it was decided to reduce the Canadian Army and compact it somewhat. A number of infantry battalions were demobilized, and so was the Fort Garry Horse. And we ended up with four armored regiments instead of the six we had had, and the same happened throughout the rest of the combat arms. So just to say, my old regiment, the Garrys, our reserve regiment, and a very healthy one at that, in the city of Winnipeg, from whence they came back in 1912. The rest of my career, that is to say from 1967 onwards, was in logistics. I was in the Army Service Corps, specializing in transport. The Service Corps also provided administrative services. It's where we trained all our cooks and stewards and clerks. So we were in that end of the business. And I must admit that the support end of looking after the Army is very interesting indeed. There's a lot of room there for personal, let's call it career growth, learning how to look after troops at the sharp end. Keep them fed, keep them clothed, fueled, and plenty of ammunition. That was the role I fell into. I had a number of other things through my career. I retired from the headquarters of one Canadian division in 1991, but ended up fairly quickly with back with the reserves with a full-time job helping to look after my hometown unit, which I joined in the first place, called the Royal Highland Fusiliers of Canada. My wife also was busy with her military career at the time, and she was advised that progression depended on her becoming functional in the French language. And there happened to be a vacancy at the language school in Victoria, BC. So we got posted out there from Southern Ontario, and she passed her course and everything. But that is where I finished my business with the military, in that I joined the local unit, the Canadian Scottish Regiment, as their quartermaster, and was my birthday in 1997 was sent a birthday greeting from the commanding officers telling me I had to turn in my kit. I was too old to stay any longer. So that was the end of any kind of active or reserve service for me. Carrying on with her, though, I became the dependent husband, as they call them, or dependent spouse of my wife, who is doing quite well with the Canadian Forces. Thank you very much. And we ended up spending 4 years in Norway, where she was posted. And I found there an opportunity to work my way down the career ladder even another step, and became a civilian clerk of National Defense. Paid quite well for it, thank you. Looking after the rest of our dependents during our stay in Norway.
What year were you married?
We were married in 1980.
Oh, okay, so. Okay.
With the career manager standing, our joint career manager standing behind us with a shotgun, because that was the only way that he was going to keep us together. We had been occupying the same house for 3 years prior to that, but that was a great motivation to get married, so we could stay together on postings that summer. Mm-hmm. Which incidentally, relevant to this interview, that anniversary is tomorrow, the 16th.
Oh, congratulations. Do you mind just me ask, I know you've already told me about your time, but what did your day-to-day activities look like while you were posted in Germany in 62?
I would say 90% of it was on tank maintenance. These things were like British sports cars. They were cranky, cantankerous, and required a lot of TLC. Yeah. On the other hand, looked after, they performed admirably well. In fact, they were possibly the best piece of armored equipment in the theater, and that included our potential opponents and our allies. I must say the British were equipped with the same tank, so. So day to day, it was a morning parade, squadron parade, and it only took about 5 minutes or so. Sergeant Major make a couple announcements. Once in a while, the squadron commander, a major, would appear with greetings of the day. And then we were dismissed we all headed down to the tank hangars and truck hangars and the like to look after the beasts. Frequently, there was a small training area out behind the garrison, and often we would do troop drills. Troop drills meaning three or four tanks, depending on the troop size at the time, and we'd practice how to handle defiles, move from cover to cover, just plain driving. My job in the tank was loader and radio operator, which was handy because I got to see everything that was going on as well.
So in the event of hostilities, you would have actually been in the tank?
Yes. Now, there was another time in the thing I was driving an ammunition truck, so I would have been left with that chore, and that was a busy enough chore to do. Simulated when we went to the ranges, we did ammo runs to and from the magazines to the ranges. And a busy tank regiment can burn a lot of fuel and use up a lot of ammunition pretty quickly. So it's like a washing machine cycle. You're always either going back to pick up more or delivering combat supplies to the tanks right up front. In the latter part, I had the good fortune to be promoted to a rank you don't hear of anymore, called Lance Corporal. And with that, I was sent to regimental headquarters as a radio operator in the regimental command post. So in 1965, had anything happened there, I probably would have been, there's no doubt I would have been part of that headquarters crew of the regiment. I wouldn't have gone back to tanks unless there was absolute crisis of unit survival. I would have stuck with them, or been kept there, I should say. Wasn't a choice open to me or any other person in my rank. You went where you were assigned and told to go and expected to do as good a job as you possibly could under the circumstances at the time. There's a long way of saying fight and hope to live.
Where were you stationed during the 1968 Trudeau election?
I was in Camp Wainwright at the time.
That's Calgary, correct?
It's in the almost on the Saskatchewan border, about 2.5 hours east of Edmonton.
Okay.
So from Calgary, it was a drive to the northeast, and it'd take about the better part of a day with military convoy speeds. Interesting you ask, though, connecting it to the election. I was appointed at the time by the camp commander to be the returning officer for Elections Canada for the camp to collect the military vote. So that was my introduction to how the political system works, because we had to attend briefings run by Elections Canada and the like on how to conduct the vote. So the military vote's a little more complicated than the civilian vote, in that a soldier then and now could vote for in his home riding, regardless of where he was stationed. So at the time, I didn't vote in the Wainwright area. I voted in Waterloo County in southern Ontario. The riding was called South Waterloo at the time. But anyway, that was a very interesting insight into how we vote.
Did the military support Trudeau? I don't know if it was known at the time how uninterested in the military Trudeau was. It became quite obvious in the next 2 years. But
yes, the military is both officially and unofficially fastidiously neutral, as we must be.
Yeah.
Sometimes a little chit chat about a particular politician, say an MP, might arise in the mess, but the military was apolitical, and that's as it should be in a democracy. So should the police, for that matter, and I'll extend that. It's not true anymore, but it should also be the case for the public service. Because regardless what you might personally think or wish to see politically, the military and the public service and all the rest that belong to a particular government has to serve whoever wins and serve them loyally. So hence, it's the easiest way to do that is just to stay apart from the political side of it. And when asked, make your case for more and better equipment, a better and more efficient and well-equipped army or air force, as the case may be, or navy, and hope that they take your advice, the politicians take your advice and do that. It must be said, just going back to those days, things got pretty grim, career-wise and equipment-wise and combat status-wise by the early to mid-70s. And then through some, it was a deliberate decision, all right, and Prime Minister Trudeau was in, was the chief at the time. There was a huge infusion of money and funds that came to the military for new equipment, particularly in 75, 76, 77. A new defense minister and a long-running program to refurbish the military, which had been in decline actually starting in about 66, 2 years before Mr. Trudeau was elected. The government of the day, both the Diefenbaker government and the Lester Pearson government, there was no money, and they knew it, and they knew changes would have to be made, and that was the driving force to unify the forces into one force, so to speak. It was an issue of money, not somebody's, let's call it fantasy or wild dream or anything like that. It was, we had to reduce somehow or other, and that was one of the, for forces small as ours, for instance, why have three separate supply systems when we already had a unified medical system, postal system, and dental system for all three services? Why not extend that into some other areas like supply, maintenance, engineering, and clerical processes and things? And that's what happened. And it was, so I went all through that cycle too. Just anecdotally, it might be worth saying for this thing that I was posted in to CFB Montreal at the time of the FLQ crisis, and that became a very busy autumn of 1970 and into 71, as the city and the province was full of federal troops. So it was not business as usual at all. Did a lot of contracting, at least my section did, transport, a lot of contracting with bus companies, transport companies, all kinds of people, for the necessary transportation we needed for the to deal with that situation. But I was right on the doorstep of it. For instance, to go home at night to our base housing, or permanent married quarters, as they were called. I had to pass through barbed wire blockades and whatnot, and guards who checked my ID and that of my family anytime we went in or out of the places to make sure that we were authorized or okay to be in there. So that was a bit thing. And seeing as we're talking about the generality of time spent in the Army, I spent a lot of, after Montreal, a lot of time in the Army of the West, as we liked to call it at the time, based in Calgary, with the service battalion there, and there was a number of other units before the move to Edmonton in the 90s. So it's, which I had wasn't living out there then. And I spent 6 years in National Defense Headquarters and half a year in the Golan Heights on a UN peacekeeping mission. But that was the subject of another one of these MOH things, and that is on record with another young lady who I met up with a couple of years ago. They were particularly interested in UN peacekeeping service and things, so my account of being over there is already on record. You have any, I'm not in a rush at all, but if you've got other questions, please ask them.
Yeah, so I know that in 1970, the Trudeau government decided to essentially gut the 4 Brigade that was over in Germany.
Yes.
Did you feel the ramifications of that at all back in Canada?
No, at the time, let's see, that's, I was in Wainwright at the time. I guess the biggest impact on me personally was the taking the Fort Garry Horse and a bunch of other regiments and battalions out of the order of battle for the Canadian Army Regular, or at that time it was called the Canadian Forces Land Environment, or Force Mobile Command. I'm not sure strength changed much, because what they did with the demobilized units is they brought the remaining ones up to strength with the personnel. Nobody was forcibly retired or anything. We couldn't afford that. But it was clear that we couldn't afford a bunch of understrength units either. So they compacted things a bit, and we got along. There's sadness over it. A whole bunch of beer and tears spilled in the messes. But we cleaned it up on Sunday morning and got on with being professional soldiers.
Do you ever wish that you were in Germany longer than just your 3 years, or did you?
Oh yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I almost asked to extend, which would have meant I would have changed hat badges and gone with the Strathconas, because I was really getting the hang of getting around in Germany and quite liked it. I didn't have a car, but there was ways to get around. And we had the beauty of being over there is instead of 30 days leave a year, we had 21 days, we had 6 weeks instead of 4 weeks, but you could only take them in 2 week batches, which was more than we could normally afford anyway, because at the time, I think it's worth mentioning here what our pay was. In 1962, when I signed up, our pay was $106 a month, gross. And that was, I thought, low, even by the standards of 1962. That was about, well, you can do the math yourself, it's about $25 a week. But room and board was included in that. But board was limited in the sense that you often occupied a room with three other chaps. You couldn't bring women into the barracks. You couldn't party in there. You couldn't have alcoholic beverages in your locker. You had to go to the canteen or mess for that, which was fine.
Yeah.
It was more convivial and so forth. But there was limitations. There's no curtains for the windows, for instance. Big deal would have just meant we would have had to launder them anyway. But I must say, though, that we were probably the best-fed army in the world. There was certainly nothing wrong with the food, ever. So that went into it. But it would net out after deductions for income tax and pension and one or two other small things. Our pay during recruit training was about a little over $20 a week. So we were paid twice a month. We had to parade for it in a huge drill hall. You lined up, you marched up in front of the paymaster, your name was called out, his clerk would say, repeat your name and then the amount you were to be paid. As in, Trooper Donaldson, RW, $40. The paymaster would peel off two 20s. You would salute. You would take the money in your left hand, salute again, do a proper right turn, and march off. If you didn't do it right, the instructor over down the side would make send you back through another chain, give the money back, and you had to do it again until you did it right. So that's how we got paid. Even at 20 bucks a week on payday, I always had $2 or $3 left in my pocket, mainly because I didn't smoke. The others were, days before that, were rifling the large ashtrays in the hallways of the barracks, looking for butts to strip and roll into a homemade cigarette out of desperation. They never got it that they should buy a carton immediately after being paid and stick that in their locker, enough to last them until the next payday. But that was how it was back then. I had occasion much later on to ask a new member of a unit I was with, the 1st Canadian Signal Regiment, what he got paid as a recruit. And he said, oh, well, it was okay. And he was being paid at the time $26,000 a year. I almost fell on my office floor because our pay gross at the time was a little over, it was about $1,280 a year.
Wow.
So, and they're paid even more today.
Yeah.
So there you go. Those are the differences. And I tell you, life is a lot, I think life is a lot easier in the forces these days than it was back when they were, they weren't cruel or mean to you so much, but if you were sad about something, you were invited to take it up with the padre.
Yeah.
And stop your whinging and get on with whatever it was you were supposed to be getting on with. And we loved it, actually. It was, we became, if we weren't fit when you entered, you were fit by the time you finished basic training. And if you were in a combat arms unit, you generally, they kept you fit. Dental and medical services were all provided at no cost to us. Cost to the taxpayer, but we did all right. We were fine. And it just kept getting better and better over the years. Pay, benefits, and other things. So for that, I'm grateful. I wouldn't have wanted to do anything else.
Just a couple of things in closing. How do you evaluate the four brigades' contribution to NATO over its entire time?
That's a very good question. In fact, I didn't think of that, but I'm glad you asked it. Our brigade was, you could describe it as a heavy brigade. It was capable of independent existence, independent of four divisions, services, troops, for instance. Brigades, when combined as generally as part of a division, don't have their own engineers or their own signals or things like that. Those are all provided by the division. Well, we came to Germany complete with engineers, a signal squadron, which is a large organization, actually, our own medical services, everything. We even had an Honest John rocket battery, which was capable of firing missiles with nuclear warheads on them, if released. And so we became the heavy brigade of 4th Infantry Brigade, or 4th Infantry Division. And the Brits were very happy to have us in their order of battle because we were not only paid professional troops, as opposed to most European armies at the time relied on conscription, by some people quite a bit less motivated than ourselves doing compulsory service. we were, I would say, very well equipped, and became even, by the time we were ready to go back to Canada, a whole bunch of new equipment in the form of armored personnel carriers showed up, and the tanks were being upgraded once again at the time we left. And it's so the British, yes, were very pleased to have us, and we were very much an asset to that, to 4th Infantry Division and the British Army on the Rhine generally. Yeah, we were the kind of asset various other formations would have fought over to have us camped in their brigade area or division area.
Is there anything else you'd like to share, general or otherwise?
Well, it's just over 37 years, which includes my reserve time, or time spent with the reserves. It's been up and down and in and out and all over the place, from contributing, making a grand contribution, not me, but the Canadian Army, grand contribution to NATO for many years, and to international stability operations such as peacekeeping. 6 months up in the Golan Heights was extremely interesting, especially if you like history. Just a little anecdote from there that I mentioned to a chap yesterday. I remember driving, having some business to do in the Israeli city of Tiberias on Lake of Galilee. And I drove down from our camp, which was up at about 30, same elevation as Calgary, about 3,800, 4,000 feet thereabouts, and drove down to Tiberias, which is about 600 feet below sea level. And down at the bottom, I stopped for a minute just to take my bearings before entering the city. And I was stopped by a point in the highway that it was worth getting out of the car to take a couple of pictures of or just gaze around. Dead ahead of me were two mountains called the Horns of Hittin. And that is where the Crusaders were thoroughly defeated by Saladin and his Saracen Arabs mounted cavalry and whatnot, and largely where the Crusades came to an end. Off to my right, about 7,500 meters, was the Mount of Beatitudes. To my left, about the same distance, maybe 100 meters, was the synagogue in which it is thought or theorized was where Jesus of Nazareth was learning to be a Pharisee. About a half a mile to my left front was the shore of the Lake of Galilee and what is said to be St. Peter's fishing shack, if you like, or home and first church on the shores there. All within, and Mary Magdalene's tomb just within eyesight down the further ahead along the road. And my impression was at the time, talk about standing on the ground of history. Everywhere you couldn't look, left, right, back or front, without staring at thousands of years of history. And the road I had been driving on had been one of the main routes from Tiberias or Galilee to Damascus. And so many camels, soldiers going to and from, had trod that road for thousands of years. So.
Yeah, it's incredible. This concludes the Military Oral History Program with Bill Donaldson on March 15th. And I would just like to thank you for your time.
You're welcome, Mary.
You just have to...